My name is Marta, and I'm head of biology at Nicholas Breakspear Catholic School in Hertfordshire. I'm going to be your host for this evening. So I've been presenting the Science and Faith show for seasons 1, 2, and 3. This is our season number 4. And season 4, we're going around university chaplaincy. So this is our last event. We've been in Bangor, Bristol, London. So we've been to a few places to take the Science and Faith conversation to students as well. And so seasons 3 and 4, which have been on the road, are happening thanks to a generous grant from an organisation called ECLAS, which stands for Equipping Christian Leadership in an Age of Science, and they're based at St John's College in Durham. So we're very thankful for their generosity. And I'm co-directing this project with the Dominican over there, there's 3 Dominicans here. So Father Robert, who is prior of Blackfriars Cambridge, so thank you so much for you're just putting up with me for the past few months, so thank you. So without further ado, very pleased to, hopefully you know Paige and Andre, and then we've got Michael O'Duffin, and we've got Professor Maria Obiali. I'm going to let them introduce themselves, tell us a little bit about their professional background. So Professor Maria Obiali, if you want to get started, thank you.
Yes, so I'm Maria, I'm from Italy, as you might gather from my accent, and I did my PhD in Edinburgh, so I was at this chaplaincy very often, and it's like coming back home, because I was spending many of my afternoons here between 2006 and 2010 when I graduated, and then after my PhD in here, which was in theoretical particle physics, I moved to Germany, and then I spent a bit of time in Belgium, and then I went to Cambridge, where I started with the Royal Society Fellowship, and then I became lecturer in the Applied Mathematics and Theoretical Physics Department, and I recently became professor of theoretical particle physics and phenomenology. And yeah, so that was my career. So I've been studying, basically my research is all about theoretical particle physics, so the questions about what are the elementary building blocks of reality, their interaction, and what this has to do with the origin of the universe and all the unanswered questions about our universe and how we can find new physics, especially at this big experiment that you might have heard of at CERN, which is the Large Hadron Collider. So this is where my research revolved on, but if you have questions, I can tell you more later. I don't want to talk too much now.
My name is Michael O'Duffin. I'm head of physics at St. Aloysius College, which is a Jesuit independent school in Glasgow. I studied physics here as an undergraduate. In fact, I was saying to someone earlier that when I came into this room this evening, it brought back many memories because I first set foot in it in October 1982. And it's much nicer now than it was then, to be honest. But it's lovely to be back here. So I studied physics here, and in those days the Dominicans had a student house next door, and I lived in that house with about 7 other students, and ended up meeting my wife there, and there she is here this evening, in fact. And we've both had a long association with the Dominicans, and are still indeed both lay Dominicans. That's been a very positive influence on me all these years. So I've taught actually with the Jesuits now for most of my career. I've done a number of jobs with them. I was housemaster at one point, assistant headmaster for a while, and I'm now focusing mainly on running the physics department, and I teach a little bit of religious education as well. And it's in that religious education that my sort of interest in how physics and faith issues sort of interact, and so I've given the freedom to develop one or two of my own little courses in that area, and that's where my interest in this sort of developed.
Andre and Paige are students here. So, Andre, why don't you tell us what it is that you do at Edinburgh?
Hi, everyone. My name is Andre, and I'm a third-year PhD student in linguistics, so a slightly different kind of science from everyone else here on this panel today. I'm originally from Singapore. I've always grown up Catholic, and my current PhD project is about Catholicism and social media. And so my interest in faith and science has come to a particularly unique perspective for me in this project, which is of course a kind of academic project, but also a personal project for me to understand something about the relationship between my faith and my work in linguistics, really.
Hey everybody, so I'm Paige. I'm a PhD student in vertebrate paleontology, and my work focuses on dead things with backbones. But specifically, the dead things with backbones I work on for my PhD are Paleocene mammals. So those are mammals that lived right after the dinosaurs went extinct. And I'm really interested in sort of ecosystems responding to really disruptive changes and how life deals with that. And so I work on pantodonts, which no one's heard of. That's okay. Mm-hmm. Ask me later. I'll tell you all the right things about them. But yes, and my background for coming to my PhD was I did a master's on dinosaurs here at Edinburgh. And then my undergraduate background, I studied geology and engineering, but did minors in mathematics and philosophy because my brain wanted to do all of the disciplines. And the math and philosophy is a lot of how I like conceptualize faith.
Great. Don't ask me to repeat the name of those dead things with backbones that you study, but what fascinates you about them?
Looking at the clock so I don't talk too long. So, pantodonts. What's very, very cool about pantodonts is before the dinosaurs went extinct, mammals never got bigger than the size of a badger. If you look around the room is full of mammals that are bigger than badgers now. How does that work? Pantodonts were some of the first mammals to grow to truly large bodies, and they did so extremely rapidly in geological time. And so they're a really interesting case study in how we get novel biological features in a whole clade of animals. So that's why they're awesome. And there's two types. There's cow hippos, which are hideous, and bear sloths, which are beautiful. And so...
They are.
So some of my PhD work has been on the bear sloth variety to try to figure out, like, in my thing, why are they so beautiful? So big, so beautiful.
Great. I believe you. I totally do. I mean, great. Andre, have you found anything, because you, it's quite interesting because your work kind of interacts in a very special way with your faith. Are there any findings that you can share with us yet about Catholicism and social media?
Yeah, there's been quite a lot of things that have come up. So I think two of the concepts that I've been working with really is trying to understand how authority and community are changing with regards to the internet. So I think what we really need is a theology of the internet, which is really yet to come forward. And perhaps this linguistics perspective that I give and the kind of micro interactional level in which people are talking about the faith might tell us something a bit bigger about how authority and community is changing in relation to how the church has typically and traditionally understood them.
So I just want to pick, because Andre mentioned that he was a cradle Catholic. I'm wondering if for the rest of the panel, are you as well cradle Catholics, or did you come to the faith later in life? Did you go to Catholic school? Anything you want to tell us about your Catholic background, and I'll let you decide who goes first.
I can say that, you know, I come from Italy, so when I was born, 1981, most people were baptized, they were doing the first communion in the parishes, but almost, you know, very few people that I grew up with actually believed in God. So it was more of a traditional thing that, you know, Italians were doing at the time. Like, so people, all kids were going to mass with their parents because that's what you were doing. But then suddenly, I think when I was 12, I started to, like, all the kids I grew up with to lose interest in faith, as if it was some old thing that your grandparents gave you and you don't really know what to do with that. But I had lots of questions about myself, you know, who I am, what can... And I was a kind of restless teenager, like trying to understand who I was. I had such a big desire for happiness and for truth and to understand. So the big question was really, who am I? And I was trying to find answers in the kind of astrology kind of stuff or personality test. You know, I really had such a thirst to understand who I was. And I never had any idea that in the faith that could be an answer for what I was looking for the happiness I was looking for, until I went to a state school, because my parents were totally against Catholic school. So I was in a state school, and when I was 15, a priest was teaching religious education there, and he was speaking about faith in such an interesting way that somehow, as if faith was the fulfillment of the humanity. So my question for happiness, my restlessness, my question about who am I could see in him that faith could be, you know, I started to want it to be with that priest and with the people in that community of young people who took faith seriously to answer to their desire for happiness and truth. So that's how faith found me, how I found faith again when I was 16. So I started to go back to church, to the sacraments. And since then, somehow, it was the beginning of the discovery that what I received in my Catholic tradition was kind of the treasure I was always looking for, but I didn't realize until someone was making me see what I could find there. So and since there, there was a, because I'm still restless, you know. It's not that I'm 42 and I feel that I've arrived, I'm settled, but somehow for me the experience of faith has really been a revolution that keeps working in my life, and I keep discovering new things. And for me, it's not the kind of tradition that it's the tradition where I can find the most interesting answer that my heart is seeking for.
And I think that the chaplaincy played a massive role for you as well.
Yeah, exactly. When I came here, you know, somehow it was a different environment with people of all nationalities, and they grew up in different environment compared to me. And I discovered, you know, the beauty that I discovered here through the people at this chaplaincy, but also through my colleagues that I met in my department, was that human beings have the same heart that is made for happiness and for satisfaction. And I saw so many people meeting Christ in so many different and creative ways, you know, people who came to faith through so many different traditions. And for me, it was amazing, because as an Italian, where everybody had received the baptism when they were little, to see people who, you know, were finding their faith at the university or later on, and somehow they had the same experience that I had, even if they came from totally different background, make me understand more what Christ is about, that is really a universal thing. It didn't depend on my background, it didn't depend on my genes or my parents, what they told me. It was a presence that could, you know, really talk to every heart.
The chaplaincy also played an important role in your life, obviously. Michael?
It has. But to answer your earlier question first, I am a cradle Catholic and was brought up in a very traditional sort of Catholic family, probably that sort of tail end of those kinds of traditional Catholic families that we certainly used to have in this country, where the local parish priest, for example, would quite regularly come and visit you at home and come in for a cup of tea and a chat sort of thing. So you really felt a very close connection with the church, and he made that his sort of mission. It was the very last of that generation, I think, that did that. And we'd little house masses. You'd have a kind of rota, all the Catholics in the street would get together, and they would sort of decide whose house it was, maybe just once a year, but he would work his way through the town doing this sort of thing. So it was very, very intimate. In primary school, we had a very traditional sort of Catholic upbringing, a very strong faith formation, but I remember from primary school loving going to Mass. For some reason, I just loved going to Mass. I enjoyed the peace of it, but that sense that there was something, I wouldn't have known the word then, but something transcendent going on. And that helped shape me very strongly. And then at secondary school, which was a Catholic secondary school as well, that's when, of course, when you're an adolescent, things begin to sort of change a bit, and some of your friends begin to sort of say, oh, that's a lot of tosh and nonsense and all the rest of it. And a very good friend of mine became a communist at secondary school, and tried to convert
early
me.
Then.
Oh, he was a rabid communist. He tried to convert me to atheism. So I started reading books by Bertrand Russell, which I found absolutely fascinating, to be honest. And in many ways, I found that particularly strengthening of my faith, actually reading Bertrand Russell, because he really made you sort of look into all the nooks and crannies of what you actually thought you know, you believed in. So we had tremendous discussions. And that particular friend also came to university here in Edinburgh, and we used to have tremendous arguments long into the night, as one does when one can stay awake that long as an undergraduate. That was wonderful. And then I have to say that the Dominicans did an absolutely wonderful job, and I'm sure they're still doing it here now, in creating a space where students can come together and discuss anything they like. And there was a wonderful freedom. I loved the way the Dominicans encourage you to discuss things and ask questions, even though they might seem as if they're not entirely the right questions, or are you going to get the wrong answer, and all that kind of stuff. And the preaching, of course, was just wonderful and really stimulating and thought-provoking. So all of that sort of combined, and I'd kind of tested my faith all through my adolescence and what have you, and it was always tested here. There used to be a wonderful series here back in the 80s after the 7:15 Mass on a Sunday called Arguments Against Catholicism, and they would invite someone who wasn't a Catholic, and in fact who was quite antithetical to Catholicism, and he or she would give a talk setting out their stall, and then we'd all have this wonderful debate about it. And I really loved that kind of cognitive engagement and conflict that you used to get, and it was really sort of testing of the faith. But amidst all of that, you would then return to the peace and the quiet and the devotion of Mass and Lauds and Vespers, which we went to all the time. So yes, I've received a very blessed formation in so many ways, to be honest.
Paige.
So many cradle Catholics here. I'm one as well. I don't think that I could escape it with four Italian grandparents. And for me, I went to the parish school and then a Catholic secondary school, so I had 12 years of Catholic education. And that was really important because I had a learning disability, and I probably couldn't have done as well in like the larger government schools that were available in my state. So what's been very important for me from my like Catholic background is like sort of from the point where I started like learning, I've been in like a situation that like recognizes my potentiality and is willing to help me like step through things. And then when I did my undergrad at university, my first job was working at a Newman Center, which is like the US equivalent of a chaplaincy. And so I graduated high school, I started working at a Newman Center in like peer-to-peer mentorship and working at the parish associated with it. And then when I came to Edinburgh for my master's, I had gotten this incredible opportunity to work on these new fossils. And one of the things that I am not good at is applications. So I applied for so many scholarships, terrible, awful experience of just so much rejection. And I managed to land a few small ones, but the church was what made up the gap. So my parish got together some money for me, and the Carmelite Monastery in Reno got together some money for me to like send me to Edinburgh. And then, you know, I landed here with knowing one person in the UK, which was my PhD's advisor, and sort of landed in the chaplaincy. So, and here, like, you know, I'm sometimes a bit of a problem child, but again, people see potentiality. And so, like, my intellectual life is the most important thing to me, and it's sort of all I'm here in the UK for, but like the church like sees my potential and then draws it out. So like, that's sort of where I am.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask you to tell me what your favorite thing about your faith is and what your favorite thing about the science that you have studied or teach is. You look ready, Andre.
So maybe if I can say three things in which I find that I like best about the two things about my faith and about my work. The first is that it's true. I think the one thing that I appreciate about the faith is that I know it's true, and I can, you know, it gives me a way in which I can kind of understand the truth. And in that same way, I think my own scientific work is interested in finding out a different kind of truth, perhaps a different kind of question that we are asking in relation to particular contexts that I'm studying. The second thing I think is that it provides me with a way of seeing. So I think linguistics very much so allows us to see the world through the eyes of language, and it allows us to understand how language is central to the experience of our day-to-day lives. And I think my faith also gives me a different perspective in that. It allows me to see the world through the enchantment of Catholicism in the kind of my ability to find God in the things that I do and the people that I meet. And so it is really a way of seeing for me. And I think the third thing is that it's fun. So I think it's fun to be Catholic and to participate in the Catholic culture, to talk to other people about obscure corners of the faith and about our practice of the faith and memes and things like that, which is part of the kinds of things that I look at, of course. And it is quite so the same with linguistics as well, which I think is quite fun in giving us a language to talk about something that we already might know of but might not have the right words to describe the kinds of things that we do with words and with text, you know. And so just to be able to see that, I think it's quite fun for me.
Yeah, so I think the thing that I like the most about let me talk about faith first, is that it introduced me into a way of talking about things that in which you don't have to deny anything. So it's as if I always found that somehow, you know, to fit in a place you have to be in a certain way and forget other aspects of you. So what I found in faith is a unity in my person and in the knowledge and in everything. So it's as if I don't have to deny any aspect of reality, like my limits, my sin, death, suffering, joy, happiness. So everything goes together in the you know, in God made man. It's as if every aspect of humanity is embraced. And I found for the first time that everything of me could be embraced. In, you know, I found like the apostles when they met Jesus, how they could they say he was the Messiah? And I found the same experience for me. So that's what excites me. And it's always making me want to discover more about faith. So it's never something that I possess, but it's something that I feel blessed to have and to keep having and discovering more. And the same thing in science. So what I really like about the science we do is that, you know, so the daily work of a scientist, of a researcher in theoretical physics can be dry sometimes because, you know, I tend to do lots of mathematical equations and very often I make mistakes and then finally I found a mistake in my calculation and then the equation makes sense and then you have to put your equation into a kind of computer program and compare to the experimental data and see if it makes sense. So in all of that, there is lots of dryness in a sense, lots of days where there is nothing really, I don't know, so cool about it. You know, it's just so one has a romantic idea of a scientist where every day you discover something new. Actually, the daily life is much harder. You know, it's not that every day I discover something new, but it's so the moment when I understand something or I manage to make sense of an equation or I compare it to the data and it makes sense or there is something that doesn't work and makes you discover something new is like when you really find a piece of gold inside the mud. So it's really worth really putting your hands into the mud and walking through the mud because you do find these little bits of gold that make everything worthy. So I think the moment of total happiness you find sometimes when you understand something, I wouldn't give back for anything else in the world, for a more secure job or for a more paid kind of job. So I'm happy about what I do.
Well, for me, like all human beings, we find ourselves in a predicament, the predicament of existing, and our self-consciousness, I suppose, and our intellect naturally drive us to want to try and understand this sort of predicament. So for me, it was trying to understand something about why I'm here and where I'm going. So my faith for me, my Catholic Christian faith, when you take all aspects of it in the round, provides a sort of intellectual satisfaction to the meaning of my life and its purpose. But it also touches the heart as well. There's an emotional need that's satisfied, I think, in it as well. It provides a context for goodness, for beauty, and for truth. And it just provides an overarching sense of coherence to my life and its existence and my relationships with my family, my wife, my children, friends, and everyone else I meet. So it just seems to essentially answer these deeper questions in a different way from the way physics answers questions, interestingly, but it answers them in a very satisfying way, which to me makes sense. And I think we all have this need to make sense of our lives. In terms of the physics, I'm teaching adolescents essentially physics. I do find that very satisfying, I have to say. It's the combination of the relationship with the youngsters and the teaching and the learning of a very coherent, logical, systematic sort of discipline, which is a very satisfying thing to work with.
I also think that one of the things that I most love about the Catholic faith is there's a really deep intellectual tradition, but it's mediated and moderated by love, and they can't actually be separated out. And so it demands that we integrate our rational and emotive elements of ourselves. And what's cool about that is, like, the way that that works is, like, we're trying to approach these mysteries of God, of existence, but the only way we can understand any of this is because of relationship. And so that requires your rational and your emotive self to be integrated. And so it's cool because it's this deeply intellectual, deeply relational framing that requires both your brain and your heart to be switched on to engage well. And what's neat about that is actually to do good science, you also need your brain and your heart switched on. Like a fully rational scientist isn't picking up the intuitive vibes that help you make connections. And so sort of resonating again with the big kids in the room, what I really like about being a scientist is being on the brink of the known. Because like exploring questions that like other people haven't quite had the space to explore, or walking down intellectual pathways that other people haven't yet walked down. Like, yes, it's very frustrating. Yes, there's no answer book. Yes, like sometimes you want to throw your computer out the window and weep. But it's brilliantly human. And I think it actually gets at like why we're like so interesting and unique and like blessed animals. And then just like, because I'm a muggin, I'm a field scientist. When I get to go outside and bother rocks, that's the best. No computers, just rocks. And sometimes a good fossil. And that's like not what I most love, but my favorite part of the job is outside with rocks. It's when I feel most, feel closest to God and most in my own body. Yeah.
Great. So at this point, I'm going to ask Andre and Paige if they have any questions for the elders. She has officially labeled you.
Yeah, so both of you are physicists, and more in the pre-panel discussion than in the discussion today, we talked a little bit about how the questions that we can ask with physics hit limitations, and that, you know, eventually you'll reach points in studying physics where, like, we just can't grab hold of it with the tools that we have in science. And so the question that I have was actually if we could speak a little bit about how we avoid falling into like God of the Gaps arguments, specifically in the context that you both are sitting in as physicists. Yeah.
Well, I remember studying physics here, always being very impressed at the physics lecturers in their sort of sense of the limits of what physics could actually say. There was a humility about them when they would say, well, beyond this, we really have very little to say because there is no evidence. There sometimes can be theories, of course, and speculations, but they're quite happy to accept we've hit the buffers here, and certainly at the moment we don't see anything else. So if you're thinking as a physicist, you're not going to invoke God in the first instance, so you're simply going to say, well, I've reached some of the boundaries, or at least the current boundaries of what physics can actually say. I think from the Christian perspective, I wouldn't really be looking for God to fill in any gaps, because for me God has created the matter and energy that physicists are studying in the first place, so it's really just not an issue. I've got no kind of concern sort of with that. We do sometimes hit buffers in discussions with pupils, and I just say the same thing to them. I say, well, from the physicist's point of view, we really can't sort of say any more on this one. We could have a philosophical debate about it, or even a theological one, but it's not going to be a physical one.
Yeah, exactly. So I just want to give you three examples. So the first example is exactly what Michael was saying. You know, a very good colleague of mine was giving some lectures about the standard model, which is the model of particle physics we have. and he was calling his lectures like the miracles of the Standard Model, because our models of particles has so many coincidences in it. So things have to work down to the 30th digit for the world to be the way it is, for the proton not to decay, and for the universe to be stable and whatever. So, and he's really one of the most atheist colleagues I have. And I was really struck by the fact that he called his lectures the miracles of the Standard Model. And he went through and explained really, really well what are all these strange coincidences that we encounter when we study theoretical physics about that. And then he said at the end, he said, you know, I want to study. So the reason why I study theoretical physics is to prove that all these coincidences are not actually miracles, because you can create via some mathematical tools the theory of the multiverse. So there are billions of universes that can happen at the same time. So our universe is just a random fluctuations of the many possible fluctuations. So these things are not a miracle. And then I asked him from the audience, but Ben, do you think that your position, is it more scientific than my position, who believes that there is a one creator who made the universe the way it is because he wanted us to be here? And he said, not at all, you know, these are two positions and you can choose, you know, which one you want. So I really like the honesty that some scientists have, not all of them, that somehow we are in front of the same wonder, the same awe in front of reality, in front of nature. And in front of that, there is your freedom. You know, God doesn't prove his existence through the laws of, you know, through these coincidences. So it's up to human freedom whether you want to see this as a sign of God's existence or not. And I value, you know, the value of freedom, that he can say no in front of it. And there are even mathematical tools that are planted in his brain and in my brain to build a theory that doesn't need God. We all in front of the same evidence. So I think this is the kind of limit that, if you're honest, you do see that there is a limit in what you find. And then there is your freedom, who can choose. But the other thing, you know, I don't want to say, because in my experience, so sometimes we reduce our faith, saying, okay, up to here I can go with science, and from here forward I have to go with faith, which in a sense is true. But I think what Michael was saying about the fact that God is at the basis of everything, I can see it existentially. So for example, the question that Jesus asks to his friends, you know, when he says, what advantage has man if he gains the whole world and loses himself, or losing his own soul? I don't think there is any more relevant question for a scientist, you know. So I really think that the question that we are asked in faith are the most relevant question as human beings, because it's a question that, to me as a scientist, I find the most appropriate as a researcher. Because who cares if you win all the grants, that if you publish 2,000 papers and you become a very renowned person, if you lose your own soul? So if you lose the passion you started from, so that sense of total, you know, and childish curiosity in front of the universe. And lots of my colleagues, somehow they find at some point in their career that they do gain everything, you know, all the prizes they could get, and they lose themselves. So I think the question of Christ is the most relevant to human beings. You know, why do you care of winning all these things if you're losing the source that put this curiosity in your heart? So I think it's a Christian question, but it's a human question. So I find it, so there is a unity. It's not that Christ is only for people who want to go beyond the limit, but Christ is the answer for those who want to live reality in fullness. So that's a point that always strikes me. And the other one, if I can talk another, sorry, this friend that through whom I meet faith, you know, said, but Maria, how can you live as if God doesn't exist? Because if he doesn't exist, at some point you stop doing everything that is risky, and you just bind yourself within your comfort, you know, your comfort zone. And I can see that even in research, the having faith or not make a big difference, because if I'm just attached to myself and I believe that the whole world depends on myself, I only do research on the things that I think I can do, and I'm afraid of going beyond that because I have myself to defend. Well, if I believe that God exists, this gives me the kind of courage to go beyond, because I trust that there is something bigger than me, and that it doesn't matter in the end, you know, what is my own power, my own gain. So I think God is very much not in the gaps, but in the reality. I don't know if what I said makes sense, but for me it's important.
Thank you. Andre, have you got a question for the panel?
Yeah, so I thought that maybe something that we can talk about is about our experience of being Catholics in academia. And this is a kind of particular challenge that I've kind of realized in my own PhD experience. And I think this might have started when I was applying to PhD programs, and I was telling, I had this proposal that I wanted to work on something to do with Catholicism, and people, well, these were professors who knew something about me and who knew that I was Catholic, were not sure whether I could write to do academic work about Catholicism in a kind of objective way, you know, seeing that I was Catholic myself. And I think, I suspect that when I go for conferences and meet and tell other people, other academics or the linguists about my project, I think there would be many quite, you know, liberal people with liberal political views in academia, perhaps, and who might be suspicious about the faith in for whatever reasons that might be. And I think, I suspect that affects how they see me and my work as well. And so, yeah, this is not kind of, you know, resulted in any huge fights at these conferences yet, but I suspect that this is a kind of view that other people might have about the work that we do and our ability to be objective in some way.
So how do each of you, if at all, are able to bring faith and science together?
Well, we have a formal curriculum to follow, so when I'm teaching physics, I'm teaching physics. We sometimes you know, get off on tangents. I love going off on tangents. Mm-hmm. And we have great sort of discussions. And that sometimes leads into kind of theological or sort of philosophical sorts of ideas. But generally speaking, they're kept, in my context, quite separate. And then we have RE classes, of course, where that's much more free and sort of open-ended. And although I'm not a Catholic teaching in a kind of secular environment, because I teach in a Catholic school, I am a Dominican working in a Jesuit environment, which can sometimes feel quite similar. But the Jesuits have a great educational tradition, and one of their great mottos is finding God in all things. So one of the things I admire about them is that they are embracing of all disciplines, all scientific disciplines, all sort of artistic disciplines and what have you. They see all of these things as a way of exploring God's creation and giving him glory, and so they're very supportive of that, and that manifests itself in the way that they design their curriculums and the way that that teaching is taught. And you can see the benefits of a Jesuit education. And when one of my pupils said to me one day, he said, "Sir, do you know what I really enjoy about the Jesuits?" I said, "What's that?" He said, "They find things in all gods." I said, "I think you might have that the wrong way around."
Yeah, I think a good friend of mine mentioned once that theology is the queen of all sciences. So, in a way, I like that view of, you know, science is theology in a way. It was called natural theology not long ago, wasn't it, to study the natural world. So what about you, Anne-Marie? Are you able to talk about science and faith?
Yeah, I think it's so in the first instance is not something that I can do, in a sense, in the University of Cambridge. I'm in the only college that doesn't have a chapel, because religion is considered an enemy of women, you know, whatever. So I'm in an environment that is not religion friendly many times. But I think, again, I am what I am. So who... everything I am is shaped by my faith, you know, and I'm one. I cannot have a face in the department and a different face when I go to church and a different face when I'm with my family. So, and I always find it a blessing if someone is curious about that, you know, and ask me questions. At that point, it's a possibility of a relationship where people who maybe have always considered religion as something silly or just something to laugh about, because of course a scientist can be Christian, but which is, you know, clearly an ideology is not true, but somehow there is a prejudice that people don't even think about, you know, because they never met anything that contradicts this prejudice. So somehow the beautiful thing is when it happens that your being, you know, with all your limitation, can make people ask a question, and you can witness your faith and your life through that curiosity. So I had a colleague who grew up in the Soviet Union, very atheist, and he never heard talking about God until, I think, when in 1991, when church opened again in Russia. Some Polish students went to invite Russian students to go on a pilgrimage with them to Częstochowa. So he said yes. So he ended up in this group of Catholic Polish people, and he heard for the first time prayers and songs to Our Lady, and this thing put a seed in his heart, you know, the question that Dostoevsky asked, is it possible that a modern man can really believe in the divinity of Christ, you know? And then this question remained buried for many years until we were at a conference, you know, 30 years later, and I asked him to give me a lift because I wanted to go to Mass, and we were in Santa Barbara in California. And I said, oh, do you go to Mass? Oh, yeah, sorry. Do you believe in God? Yeah. So at that point, you know, that guy started to say, oh my God, so you brought back the question that this group of Polish students in 1991 brought in my heart. So how can you believe really in the divinity of Christ, you know, and you're a son? And now we are really good friends, and he started to explore faith, he lives in Texas, so he's different. But, you know, somehow it was beautiful because I didn't do anything, but just the fact that I asked a lift to go to Mass somehow has reawakened in him a question that this group of Polish students, and it's so beautiful. There is such a friendship that was born with him, and people ask, but why are you so friends? And he's the one who witnessed, you know, because Maria brought me back to faith. Oh, is Maria Catholic? So, you know, so sometimes there are all these discussions that happen at conferences. And it's beautiful because somehow I have to do nothing but just be. And, you know, an answer question, and God does everything. So that's my impression, that sometimes it gives me a lot of peace, the fact that I just have to be and witness what I am, and then God works in reality and in my students' hearts.
Preach the gospel, and when necessary, use words, so witness. Pass on the microphone figuratively to Father Robert. He's going to lead us in this Q&A session, so he's got the questions there with him.
Okay, so here's a question for Maria. So how do your students or colleagues do they find out that you're Catholic? So how might they find out? Like, do you have like a cross in your office or anywhere? Or do you ever wear a cross? Or
I don't wear a cross, but I have it in my office, both in my office in college. I have a beautiful poster and an icon that I keep in my office for them to ask if they want to, or just to. So yes, that's a sign I have. And then somehow, sometimes I talk about, you know, I went to church, or I just say, you know, things like that. So somehow, if they're attentive, they can guess.
Mm-hmm. What kind of icon is it?
It's an icon of Mary. It's a beautiful icon that comes from the Holy Land. It's the Mary, Queen of Heaven and Earth. So it's Mary and lots of people around her. It's beautiful.
Okay, so here's another question. Many Christians are in denial of facts proven by science, such as evolution and particle physics, as they feel science conflicts with their faith. So have you ever faced any such conflict as this? And what would you say to these people as a scientist?
So as a scientist, I think for me, it's fundamental. It's the most important thing is that faith and reason work together. I couldn't believe in a religion that goes against reason and against the findings of science, because it would mean that my humanity has to split into the believer and the scientist. You know, I want, as I said, for me, faith embraces the whole of my humanity, my desire to understand, my desire for meaning, everything. So I think sometimes there are some ideological things in Christianity, you know, taking the Bible, you know, our faith as the religion of the book, and taking the message in a literal way. I'm not a theologian, but I think, you know, sometimes there is an ideological way of faith that is what causes a lot of friction more than what should be there. And I think that the supreme category of reason is the category of possibility, because in science there are so many things we don't know, and I think we should just be truthful and humble and admit the possibility that something beyond us is happening.
Can I add in, because I'm a paleontologist and the anti-evolution stuff really gets under my skin. The response that I have a lot to this is sort of the question of, like, how small is the God that we're worshiping if that's the case, that evolution couldn't be part of this or particle physics. How small, how limited? And one of the things is that our conception of God is not a limited conception of God and isn't an exclusive to what we know conception of God. And so it's actually challenging us as worshipers to, you know, integrate all of this information in and come to a broader perspective. But using faith to push away what we know about reality is making God incredibly small. And that raises the question of, is that version of God worth worshiping? So, yeah.
In my view, the God that we believe in is one that in many ways we know very little about. But we can make deductions about what we believe in. If he is the creator of everything that exists, then he's created all the building blocks of the very science that we're talking about. So we should have absolutely nothing to fear from any scientific discovery in terms of its effect on our faith in God. And essentially what I'm saying is that belief in God and any kind of scientific exploration are not in conflict.
Yeah, I think that's such an interesting question of premise. And I think if we begin with the premise that there is a unity between faith and science, I think the perspective that we will get will be quite different from having assumed otherwise. And I think in many ways, faith is a gift, and the ability to see that unity as a kind of perspective. I think as we try to become better scientists, also we try to become better Christians. And I think one of the things about becoming a better Christian is to be able to understand this unity in this particular way.
A follow-on question. So supposing that intelligent life was discovered on some distant planet, I mean, what kind of challenges do you think this might present to us as Catholics, and how might you respond to those challenges, and like to do like things with redemption and those kind of?
I remember being in the company of a Jesuit priest when he was asked this very question. The questioner asked, if an alien, an extraterrestrial alien, met you, would you baptize him? And the Jesuit said, well, if he asked for baptism. So if he's created in this universe by God, then it's entirely possible there are other life forms out there, but they must have also been created by God.
Yes, there is a lot of research about it. In Cambridge, there was the last Nobel Prize about that on exoplanets, and there are lots of things that are trying to see what are the conditions of life. So, first of all, I think these studies reveal that it's, again, the coincidences to for life to be there in the planet is extremely, you know, the likelihood is extremely small. On the other hand, our universe is big. So again, the category of possibility doesn't deny that. On the other hand, I believe that God has a plan of salvation. So he must be maybe bigger than the one we know. So in a sense, he became incarnate in a human flesh 2,000 years ago here. As who knows what happened in another planet, you know. Again, it's a category of possibility that I don't know anything about.
I agree. I think it's highly unlikely that there are aliens, but then I'm highly unlikely.
Exactly. So here's a question about what place does truth have in science? Because you get often people maybe saying things, well, maybe you can never prove something that's true in science, there's any sort of falsification, and if you have that kind of maybe idea that you can ever kind of establish the truth of anything, is that a kind of a challenge to the faith? What some of these scientists are saying, that you can only falsify things, that you can have a theory and then some evidence will come along that will either be consistent with it or it will invalidate it, but you can never prove a theory.
So science and faith both worship at the altar of truth. But to do good science, it is really important to be working from a falsification principle. Science is sort of inherently conservative. You want to stay within the realm of your data. You don't want to necessarily step outside of it. But even if you're trying to say what your data are not, right, that's a falsification thing. You know, I don't know what this is, but I know what it's not. That's still approaching questions of truth. You're saying what is not true. So you're setting it in contrast to something. Even if we don't necessarily have a perfect reality that we've, you know, approximated, we can say what it's definitely not. And that's using a principle of truth. So, yes.
But interestingly, there's still a lot of faith in many sort of scientific type situations. I say this to pupils. Every time you step on an aeroplane, you're putting faith in the engineers that built that plane. You're putting faith in the guys that have just put the fuel in. You're also having tremendous faith that when it hits 120 miles an hour, the uplift on those wings will actually get it off the ground. So you have this level of physics, then you then have a level of engineering, and everyone agrees the principles are absolutely true insofar as we can see any scientific principles true. But you still have a certain faith that they will be true this time when you actually get on the plane. So I try to say this to pupils, that they tend to think of faith always as religious faith, but in their daily lives they have faith in all sorts of things, and they don't question that faith. So it's an interesting way into religious faith, revealing to them the faith they have in other things.
And actually that faith matter much more sometimes than the kind of true, the scientific truth, you yes. know, which, yeah. I agree with everything they said. Just, you know, for me, there is also an aspect of morality, if you want, you know, the fact to love the truth more than oneself, that is important everywhere. So that for me is a trait of unity, because even as a scientist, sometimes you have an hypothesis and you spend years researching in a given direction, and then you find that your hypothesis was wrong. And it happened to me like 1 month ago. You know, I had this big European grant, and for 3 years, my student and I started from a given hypothesis, and actually then we discovered it didn't work. And, you know, and it's amazing, because then you are really... So then you have to write a paper. And then what do I love more? My own power, my credibility of the truth, you know. So I think that's a kind of moral law. It's a kind of moral debate that happens at all points in life, also in scientific discoveries, in scientific truth. So, and then at some point you have to decide if you want to do good science, and you love the truth more than your own understanding of it. So you have to say, all right, I thought that was true and it's not, you know. And it's a big challenge. I think you need to be happiness, to be happy, you know. So you need to have your foundation somewhere that doesn't make all of your life depend on your scientific discovery. And this is where, you know, what Paige was saying before, that somehow you must be So to be a scientist, you must be a human. To be a good scientist, you must be a good human being, because these are the human questions that you have to face when you work in science, and you cannot cheat. If you cheat, you start becoming a worse scientist. It's very interesting.
Yeah, I think something that we talked about as well in our kind of chats is about this, you know, what kind of questions are we interested in, and what kind of answers can science give us, and what kind of answers can faith give us? And I think our perspective of in asking this question of truth, I think the important thing is really about what kind of questions are we asking, and what are the answers we can reasonably expect to arrive at from the perspective that we are using.
Thank you. Before we say our thank yous, briefly, why have you taken the time to, you know, out of your very, very busy lives to be here at the chaplaincy tonight?
Not because this, you know, it was like coming back home. It has been a really, like, for 4 years I was always here. So it was great to come here. And also this conversation, I always learn something new from either the students or the people I'm talking with in the panel. So it's always an occasion for me to go a step farther in my journey of faith, which is never over. And so thank you for inviting me.
Well, it's always a pleasure to come back to Edinburgh. It's always a pleasure to be in a Dominican house. And I just really enjoy talking about these sorts of things. So thank you for giving me the opportunity.
Yeah, it's been a really interesting opportunity to think about this question of faith and science, especially for me, it's doing a slightly different kind of science, and to be in dialogue with all of you here today, and for the very interesting conversations that we've had so far.
Better answer, less true though. I care about both of these things. And so it's, for me, it's worth taking the time out to speak about these things I care about in ways that, like, I'm not necessarily invited to do so very often.
Great. So this is the end. This is the wrap-up for our season 4. We are on social media. We have an email account. We're on the on the website as well of Radio Maria England. And again, thank you to ECLAS for sponsoring these two seasons that we've had. It's been an absolute pleasure. So thank you.